Hi there, and thank you for downloading this podcast episode. My name's Len Metzen, and I'm a politics undergraduate student at the London School of Economics. In this episode, I sat down with Dr. Joe Greenwood Howe in March of 2021 to talk about his life in researching political science. Just a quick warning, Joe was recording in Kathmandu, where there's a large population of stray dogs, just to explain any of the barking you'll hear in the background. Dr. Joe Greenwood Howe is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Strathclyde. He completed his undergraduate degree at the University of Sheffield and his MA and PhD at the University of Essex, where he conducted an original survey looking at people's perceptions of privilege in politics and how it affects participation. Previously, he has been a data analyst at YouGov and a teaching fellow at LSE. Indeed, he taught me during my first year. He tweets at Nice One Combo and blogs at emaciatedbear.wordpress.com. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
I must say, I'm a big fan of the various online names that you have. Where do those come from?
So they both have quite obscure origins. The blog is what was a very brief nickname of mine when I was at secondary school, Emaciated Bear. And Nice One Combo is a quote from my favourite, or one of my favourite films, which is This Is England, which I think is just a sort of fantastic portrayal of a sort of slice of working class council estate life in 1980s Britain. It's a fantastic film, and that's just a quote from the film.
Very nice. So on to the substance of the podcast. You started your academic career at the University of Sheffield with a degree in history and politics, and during that time you got involved in campaigning. How do you think being involved in politics yourself and seeing these things that you're studying firsthand affected the research and the study that you're doing, and perhaps your motivations in researching social sciences?
Yeah, that's actually a really easy question for me to answer, because there's a very clear link. So there's no way I would have researched the topics I researched had I not first spent time campaigning. So the organisations that I was involved in, one of them in particular that campaigns on sort of human rights and economic justice, as well as environmental considerations, one of the things they were concerned about when I ended up working for them was sort of how accessible their campaigning was to a broad group of people. So the people who tended to get involved with their political campaigns were disproportionately middle class, essentially. And there was a sort of concern within the network about that. And they were also disproportionately white. And there were, of course, gender dynamics going on as well. And so sort of that's the first place that sparked the question of sort of why is it that some people feel more inclined or more able to get involved in certain types of politics, right? And so from there, that was the sort of the beginning of the idea of doing a master's. I then went and did a subsequent job working in a similar area of sort of engagement with students campaigning, and the same questions kept on popping up. You know, why is it that some people will immediately jump at the opportunity to get involved in politics, and other people you have to really sort of drag them kicking and screaming to do anything involved in politics? And obviously the answer to that is incredibly complicated, but that was the seed of the sort of drive for me to go and research those things. And I hadn't anticipated doing a PhD. I thought I just need a year to sort of at least familiarize myself with the literature on why different people do or don't get involved in politics. But then it went from there.
So you, when you did your master's, you weren't thinking necessarily of going on to do a PhD after that. And is that what you're talking about, the year of familiarizing yourself with that literature?
Exactly. I knew that whilst I was working full time, it was going to be difficult for me to sort of take that academic look at the subject. I was going to have loads of really good sort of practical first-hand experience of working with people in campaigning, but not really the sort of time to take that space and that critical distance to get some academic perspective on it. So that's the sort of reason that I decided to do the master's. The master's was supposed to be a sort of self-contained thing, just an opportunity for me to learn about these things from a different perspective. And I thought I hadn't ruled out further research, but I certainly didn't set out thinking, oh, I will be doing a PhD after this. But then the opportunity arose during the time that I was at Essex. In fact, my head of department invited me for a meeting and said, look, we've got this funding. We think the stuff you're working on is really interesting. We think you should apply for the funding. And that was the first time I sort of gave it any serious consideration. And then I obviously decided to put together an application.
That's really interesting, because I think a lot of researchers and a lot of scientists kind of know that they want to do that and then try and find their topic. But it seems for you that your topic came from the world around you, and then research came from that rather than the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely the direction of travel. And in fact, I was, before I did my master's, I spent an excruciatingly long amount of time thinking about whether I even wanted to do a master's on the subject of political behaviour, which is what I ended up doing, or to do something more sort of, in my mind, hard-nosed, practical, career-orientated, like a law conversion course, for instance. And after a lot of sort of contemplation, I decided that it would be better to do the thing I was really fascinated in. And so there was actually a chance that I never would have even started looking at this topic. So I clearly didn't have a kind of a career plan, you know, this is where I want to go and this is what I want to do. It was, and I mean, I'm immensely privileged to have been able to do that, to have been able to say, well, this is the thing I'm interested in, so I'll do it, you know. But I would always advocate that if people have that opportunity, they take it, right? The opportunity to work on something you really are passionate about is too good to miss.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, and definitely true in throughout your career. I'm wondering how this links to my next question. So at your master's at Essex, you started really getting into statistical work, which would suggest that you've had a long mathematical or statistical background, given the things that you're doing. So I was surprised to find out that you only started looking at statistics in your master's. And that made me think about why statistics are so scary to social science students and so seen as something that, you know, is inaccessible if you haven't done it, if you haven't done a maths at A level, if you haven't done statistics in your undergraduate degree. And I'm just wondering about your experience of coming to that after your undergraduate degree.
Yeah, so what you've just, the way you've just characterized it, I think is a really nice way of characterizing it. And it's something I encountered both as a student and then subsequently as a teacher of other students, right? Because you know, when you're a teacher, especially if you've gone through it, that this can be a worrying topic for people, basically. And so the sort of the experience of it for me was that it was scary. And in fact, if I'm completely honest, it's still scary to me sometimes, right? Or not even sometimes, quite often, you know? And there's a lot of reasons for that. So obviously, as you've highlighted, I took a big gap between a maths GCSE and then came back to statistics at a master's level. So that's, you know, years and years and years. In fact, about a decade between the two. And I treated it very much as something I had to do, because I was interested in the topics that it would help me investigate. And so there's, I think that's part of the seed of the answer is there, is that we see statistics as a tool. A lot of people see statistics as a tool. It's a thing we need rather than a thing we're necessarily passionate about. Now, obviously there are exceptions to that. There are people who are genuinely like fascinated by statistics and they really get into it. And on some level, I'm slightly jealous of them because it's a passion and it's not scary to them. But if it's just this thing you have to learn because you know it's useful, it's a very different kettle of fish. But I don't think that's the only reason it's scary. I think I was thinking about this, there's a number of other reasons. First of which is there's a whole different language associated with it, right? And that on some level is a barrier. And it means that you're automatically being told as soon as you start, you need to speak in this particular way, you need to make sure you have the terminology correct. And that, there's obviously a function to that, which is the precision of expressing ourselves. We need to be clear about what we're saying. So that's why we develop this separate language for statistics. But if you're coming to that for the first time, it can be a bit overwhelming. But also, you know, if we work in the humanities and the social sciences, a lot of what we've spent a lot of our time working with is words and ideas, right? And then we're suddenly confronted with this topic where there is sort of a pretty clear sort of right and wrong answer often, right? You know, we're going back to maths. It sort of makes us go back through to when we were learning maths at school and we were just told, well, this is how it works. Now, obviously, when you get to really high levels of mathematics and statistics, there are these huge open questions that remain and it does become uncertain. But a lot of what we learn when we're learning statistics is pretty certain stuff. And I think that can also be quite scary. We have this fear of being told that we're wrong, essentially. And so if you couple that with a new language, as well as some quite complicated ideas, it can seem scary and worrying. And I think there are ways to get around that in how you teach it. But I think those were the kind of ideas that occurred to me about why we find it a challenging topic.
I think that point about language is something that really resonates with me. And I remember being taught in my first year about regression, and it was introduced to us as tables and numbers and covariates and all of these words that I'd never heard before. And I remember going to an office hour with you, and you got up and drew on a whiteboard a scatter plot. And you drew a line through it and you said, that's what it is. This is exactly what regression is. And seeing that, what it was, and that kind of tangibility away from the abstract words of regression, coefficients, things like that, I think after that, you know, it all clicked in. But there is that kind of barrier of language. And if you haven't been introduced to these ideas, you almost miss that boat right at the start.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And the reason I teach like that, firstly, thank you. I'm really glad that that worked, because obviously that's the purpose of it, is trying to like demonstrate these concepts in different ways so they become accessible to different people, right? Because for some people, the language is fine. For other people, there's another way of thinking about it, right? And we have to figure out those different ways of thinking about it. And the part of the reason I showed you like that is because that's how I understand it, right? I had to go through that process of translating it into the basic sort of geometric expression, right? And there's a huge credit that goes here to my PhD supervisor, who also taught me statistic at master's level, a guy called Rob Johns, who's at Essex, because a lot of the ideas, the way I express statistics, come from the way I was taught it. And so I think, you know, there's a really important point there about essentially trying to figure out different ways to express the same ideas so that as many people as possible can understand them, right? Because you can't expect everyone to understand it from the language. And maybe to other people, those diagrams were no help, right? But the language helped. So that's one of the ways, I think, to overcome that fear, is to, when you sort of see that someone is struggling with it, go, okay, well, let's try and express it in a different way and think about it in a different way. And eventually, hopefully, you find the way that helps everyone understand it.
Exactly. And I think some teachers in the past that I've had have kind of, if students won't understand statistics, they would shy away from it, and they'd say, well, all you need to know is that if the p-value is above 0.5, then you say this. And it was almost taught by numbers. And I think that approach to it kind of adds to the shyness that the whole discipline has around statistics, and the lack of understanding that people have. It's almost as if there is that fear of the language and the concepts, and instead of saying, look, it's just this, it's kind of, you know, get through the exam and then you'll never need to do it again.
Yeah, and there's also a really important flip side to that, which, as I've said, I'm very willing to put my hands up here, is statistics doesn't suddenly stop being scary once you've done it for a bit. You know, you can still feel kind of caught off guard by questions. And sometimes that happens when you're a teacher. And so actually, one of the really important things when you're a teacher is to say, you know what, I'm not sure I understand this at the moment, but actually I can go away and look at it. And if I understand it, then I can help you understand it, right? And so we're all learning, basically. And I think it's a really helpful sort of collective thing to learn.
Definitely. So at your master's, you were introduced to the statistics, and you were taught these. And as you said, you also had the opportunity to go on to do a PhD at Essex. By this point, you were quite well established along the path of becoming a researcher. And you described this as something that was led by your interests. But I wonder what it was about research that that motivated you to go through a PhD, something that a lot of people find very difficult, very long and arduous. What about research and what about kind of approaching things in a social scientific way motivated you to follow your interests through a PhD?
Yeah, so it's a similar thing to what motivated me to do the master's in the first place. And I actually think that's one of the really important pieces of advice for someone who's thinking of embarking on a research career is make sure you can find research topics that you're really fascinated by, because you're going to have, as you say, you might. Now, the experience is different for everyone, right? But there's enough people for whom the PhD and doing research has its frustrating moments, its downsides, right? That you need that real passion for the topic that keeps you coming back to it. And so through the sort of thick and thin and the ups and downs of my PhD, the thing that kept me going was I really care about why some people get involved in politics and other people don't. And I still do. And that's what keeps me coming back to it now. And I don't think that I've exhausted the answers to that. And I don't think it's really possible to, and that might be a controversial point, but there's a great quote from, I think it's Einstein, which I'd have to paraphrase, but essentially the argument is that a great piece of research is shown by having more questions at the end of it than at the beginning of it, right? And I think that's true. And so, yes, to answer your question, the thing that made me embark on it and the thing that made me carry on with it in the tough times was the substantive topic of the research itself. Now, in addition, there's something else really important there, which was working with other people. And I think that can be a real support, by which I mean not only working around other researchers, just so when you're having a problem, you can say, oh, look, I'm dealing with this. Has anyone else been through this? Or do you know how to deal with it? It's not even necessarily about finding the answer, just that someone else can go, oh, I sympathize, I've been there. Right, that can be really helpful. But also, I mean, working with people who I was researching, so interviewing, you know, that's such an invigorating and enlivening thing to go and talk to people about their lives and why they do or don't get involved in politics. And similarly, on some level, you know, I ran a survey, that's, you know, I'm not personally talking to each of those people, but there's really fascinating stuff in there, you know, the trends in the data, the relationships that exist. And if you personalize that in your mind, it's just such a sort of eye-opening experience. I think there are people on the other end of this data, right? They're real people and they're really living lives. And in their lives, there's these connections between things. And that's really fascinating. And that is enough, sometimes just enough, to keep me going through the tough stuff, basically.
That thrill of thinking something about the world in abstract, then going out to the world and seeing that, I guess, is very satisfying and kind of affirming of what you're doing in a way, I assume.
Yes, so it's great because on some level you'll go out with these ideas and some of the people you talk to or some of the data you will look at will sort of affirm that. But then other times you'll meet people who'll make you think a completely different way, or you'll find a tendency in the data that shows you something else is going on from what you thought might be going on, which is also, of course, really sort of invigorating. And it makes you think, and that sort of goes back to why I said I'm not sure the work will ever be done, right? Because you're always sort of discovering new perspectives or new ways of thinking it about things or new relationships in data and things like that. So, yeah, it is invigorating.
Whilst doing this survey work during your PhD, you worked at YouGov, the public opinion company. I wonder how this came about and how it was helpful to doing that PhD.
So it came about because my funding was actually partially from YouGov. I think half of it came from the YouGov and half of it came from Research Council. And as part of that agreement, I could go and spend a short internship in the YouGov office with the political and social research team. That was partly so that I could develop my own survey, but partly so that I could get a sense of the workings of a polling company, be part of the team. And so that was a fantastic experience. I remember one of my supervisory board said to me, you know, try to keep working on your PhD at the same time as you're at YouGov. Now, maybe if I'd been a more dedicated person, I would have managed that, but it was a full-time job, and I'm so glad I had that opportunity to be part of a completely different context from my own research, you know, because your academic research has, I mean, there's some similarities, of course, in the sense that you're fundamentally trying to sort of find things out by examining data, but the pace, the number of clients you deal with is very different. But also, what was really nice about working there was that I got to work as part of a team, which was also a nice sort of, because my research was quite solitary. So that was really pleasant. But yeah, the origin of it was that my funding partially came from YouGov. And I mean, they were immensely generous with me, the amount of survey space they gave me, and then the fact that they asked me to come back and work around the 2015 general election. So yes, I have a very positive relationship with them, and I did, and I continue to, and hopefully will continue to.
That's nice. So you completed your PhD, which was about it was about people's perceptions of privilege, and then whether they go into politics. And after that, you then went to the LSE to teach. We touched on it a bit with the statistics, but generally, how did you find teaching as an academic at a university? And perhaps what are the challenges and the joys of passing on what you'd been working on for the all these years in university to other people who are, you know, starting that same journey as you, in a way?
Yeah, so I mean, it's probably been my favourite job so far, I would say, teaching. Teaching, not only I taught a bit during my PhD as well at Essex, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and then so then when the opportunity, when the job came up, at that time I was working full-time at YouGov following my PhD, and I just had to jump at the opportunity, because I actually sort of physically missed teaching, basically. That was the thing that made me go back, and my role was particularly orientated towards teaching. So I suppose the reason I really enjoy teaching is similar to one of the reasons I said I enjoy research, which is that interaction with people, right? To me, it's really a great experience to meet people who are setting out on their careers, their academic careers, whether that means actually pursuing long-term an academic career or just completing an undergraduate degree, and sort of encountering the ideas that they bring into the classroom. And that might be expressed through questions, it might be expressed through opinions. Interacting with that is something that basically keeps me alive, right? It's a fantastic experience. And the other thing that I think I really enjoy about it is being able to, like I said earlier, be open about the things I don't know. And that's really important to me, because I think teaching on some level is a kind of emotional experience, right? Part of what I need to do as a teacher is convey information and explain things and clarify things and answer questions. But part of what I need to do is also to say, you know what? We don't always know the answers to this. Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes we get things wrong, right? And that, I think, is as much what I find enjoyable about it as the sort of the intellectual endeavor, which I do find enjoyable too. So yeah, I knew I enjoyed teaching already, so when the opportunity came up, I was just like, right, I have to jump at it if I can. So that's why I came back to academia.
That's really interesting, that idea of it being a shared endeavor between you and the students, where you're both kind of learning from things from each other in different ways. You left the LSE last year to take up a position as research fellow at the University of Strathclyde, having been awarded a British Academy postdoctoral fellowship. What is it that you're now currently researching?
Okay, so yeah, so there's a very important clarifying point here, which is it might seem contradictory for me to have said how much I enjoy teaching and then applied for a post that has no teaching. So there's something I just wanted to clarify here, which is that the reason I've done that is because in order to pursue a long-term academic career, one has to have a sort of well-established research agenda, and that involves publications. And the one thing that can be difficult, and was especially difficult, I found at least in my previous role, was the balance, like finding the time to do research in amongst the teaching. So I know that I want to do teaching long term. That's the thing that really keeps me in academia. I like research, but my real passion is teaching. And so I knew that I had to sort of find the time to put my energy into getting that research agenda established. And then that would be the thing that would hopefully, fingers crossed, get me a sort of full-time permanent position in academia, during which I could then focus more of my energies back on teaching. So that's why I took that decision. To answer your question about what I'm actually researching, there's an insight into how academia works here in the answer I'm going to give, which is it's remarkably similar to my PhD. Essentially, this project is building on extending and transforming my PhD. So I'm looking not only at people's perceptions of privilege and how they relate to political participation, but also their what I call structural privilege, which is to say the resources that they have available and how they relate to political participation. So there's three components to it. One is hopefully to turn my thesis into a published book. And so I've submitted a book proposal to do that. Two is to extend it from cross-sectional survey research, which is what I did in my PhD, to experimental survey research, so that I can hopefully shed a bit of light on one small section of causality within my research. And then the third area I want to extend it in is working with political engagement organizations, sort of having got the findings I have in the bag, so to speak, and contextualized with all the other research that's been done in this area, going to organizations and saying, let's look at solutions. Like, if there is this inequality in political participation, what are ways that we might be able to address that? So those are the three sort of strands of the research. So you can very clearly see their roots in my thesis, but I hope that to get more publications is kind of one of the key goals, but also to extend, as I say, and move it in a new direction.
Touching slightly on the substance of what you're studying, I wonder if you could explain what the experiment that you're kind of thinking about is about, and what you think some of those answers might be as to why people get involved in politics in to different extents.
Okay, yeah. So when I said that I was looking at one small section of causality within the topic that I work on overall, that is fair to say that it's one small section. And I mean, that's kind of the case whenever you do an experimental study. You tend to be looking at one sort of link in the chain of events or causal links, essentially. And so the thing I hope to study, and my funding includes funding to do the field work for this, the thing I hope to study is how the indicators around politicians' status affect people's perceptions of their capacity to represent them, but also the particular innovation is I'm going to do a dual experiment. The second part of the experiment is how those indicators of status amongst politicians affect people's perceptions of their own status. So I'll try to I'll unpack that a little bit. So essentially, there's loads and loads of experiments that have already looked at the relationship between politicians' characteristics and a host of other things in populations. So whether or not people think they're representative, whether or not they want to elect them. And a lot of that has focused on things like their gender, whether or not they have physical disabilities, whether or not they're from the local area. So that sort of thing. So I'm taking a similar approach to that, but the thing I'm adding is I'm interested in whether or not these politicians' cultural interests are at all important to people. So, you know, if I randomly create a hypothetical politician and I describe them and say that, you know, on their weekends, they like to go and watch football, or randomly I describe that and I say that on their weekends, they like to go and see opera. Right, now my theory is that that conjures a very different image in the person who's reading's head, right, of the politician. Right. And I want to see whether they care, essentially. Do they rate that politician differently if they happen to have seen a politician who is exactly the same in every other respect as another politician but goes to the opera rather than football? Do they think they're more or less able to represent them? So I want to look at that. But I also want to look at whether having seen a politician who either goes to do one of those two things, and I then ask them, how would you rate your own status sort of relative to other people in society? Does them being primed on a politician who is sort of engaging in one sort of cultural activity or another make them adjust their own sort of rating of themselves in terms of their status? So you did ask me also sort of what I expect. My expectation is that yes, this will have a significant relationship with people's assessments of themselves, but also their view of the representativeness of politicians. So in other words, the politicians who engage in what we might call highbrow culture, such as opera, are going to be seen as less representative, but they're also simultaneously going to make people feel like they have lower status, because they're being reminded of this sort of high status activity that people in the political elite, in inverted commas, engage in, right? But there's a really important footnote here is, if I find no relationships whatsoever, this cultural stuff just doesn't matter, we should never forget that that is a finding in itself as well, because I have a very good theoretical reason to think that there would be a relationship. So then finding no experimental relationship is worthy of writing about as well. Right. And that's kind of one of the beauties of research on some level. If you've established a good theoretical reason why you should find something and then you don't find it, that's as interesting as if you did manage to find it on some level. So yeah, that's what I hope to investigate.
That's really interesting.
With this idea of status that you talk about, this almost taking a slightly different view of perhaps class than we're used to, because I think we tend to think of it in purely economic terms of bringing this cultural and social aspect to it as sort of slightly shifts away from perhaps what we think of as class in most kind of political science.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that I'm trying to do is to introduce this. I mean, there's a whole conversation to have about whether or not this cultural stuff is part of class or something that stems from class. I take the latter view, but I'm not certain on that. It's definitely open to debate. But it's something that's been overlooked in my view historically, is whether or not these signifiers of status that stem from things like class and gender and ethnicity, whether or not they relate in any way to people's perceptions of politics and themselves.
Right. So I guess my final question, and we touched on it quite a lot, is where do you want to take your research and what impact do you hope it has on the world?
That's a really good question. So at the beginning of my PhD, I had sort of really grand plans for sort of major impact, and I was going to be cited in loads of parliamentary reports, and my name was going to be on everybody's, oh, he's broken new ground, and some people do manage to do that. I did not ultimately manage to do that. Obviously, the third strand of my research that I described previously, where I'm engaging with political participation organizations, I do hope to still get my research out there to organizations that work on opening up politics. And that is fundamentally what I'm interested in doing on some level, is trying to find ways that mean that politics is open to people from as many different backgrounds as possible, right? So that's what I would like to do. On another level, as I've said, would be really happy to have research as the sort of second string to my bow and to get back to teaching. And I would very clearly like to have the opportunity to incorporate my research into teaching. So I've already sort of partially developed a course looking at political behaviour where I bring some of the ideas that I use in my research into that course. So that's something I would really like to do. And then if I'm completely honest, after, let's think about it, sort of, I started my PhD in 2012, so we're getting on for 10 years now. After 10 years of working on one research topic, even with the amount of sort of interest I have in it that I described earlier, part of me is really interested in doing other research now as well. So I've got loads of other ideas for sort of things that I'm interested in, that some of which have sort of tangentially emerged from my own research, and some of which have just emerged from sort of chats with other people or political events that have happened. And so I guess what I'm saying is I've found that there is some sort of intrinsic enjoyment to be had from research as well, where it doesn't necessarily have to have that sort of great political impact that I was hoping for, and which I still on some level do hope for with my original research project. But just the idea of contributing to ideas that are discussed in research arenas, but also, as I said, crucially, you know, using those ideas in teaching. So I suppose there's three outlets, really. Teaching, sort of, for the research. One is teaching, one is just academic research as a field in itself, and then the final one is trying to get there to be some impact out there in the political world.
Dr. Greenwood-Howe, thank you for coming on the podcast and talking to us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Hi there, it's me again, here for the outro this time. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it.